All right, I got everything working here.
All right, so this is Bio 241, Human Physiology, and it so happens to be, feels like Tuesday, but it's really Thursday because of Memorial and Labor Day. All right, so today is the 10th. Let's look at the schedule. We're going to finish up Interactions Between Cells and the Environment. That's Chapter 6. Next week we have two lectures, and then the Monday right after that is your first exam. Okay? So when is that? So it is, it's on a Tuesday. Sorry, Tuesday. So today's the 10th, Thursday, so it's 1.5 weeks away. 1.5 weeks away. So how are you going to prepare for that lecture exam? Study guide, make sure you understand those figures. If you have those figures in your mind, then you can answer other questions easily, like multiple choice questions. And then for the multiple choice questions, you use any questions that I have at the end of the chapter listed or any of the online questions that are listed, and just use that for practice. Right? And you might need to look over your notes and read the textbook to understand how to answer some of those questions. And there's too many questions just to memorize the answer. Some students have tried that, and then they come to the lecture and they forget what all the answers are to the questions. So it's best if you have an understanding, and that's why reading the chapter or listening to the notes again will help with your understanding. Anybody have a question on the schedule? Everybody's good with that? Okay, what do you need for a lecture exam? Calculator. A basic scientific non-graphing calculator in particular. And a business calculator won't work for you because typically they don't have a log function on them. Okay, so calculator. Oh yeah, picture ID. That's really good. Make sure you bring a picture ID because I can't release a grade to you until I see that picture ID. And 882E or 882ES. That's the Scantron. I don't know if anybody has one really handy. If you do, just kind of hold it up so that everybody can see. That looks good. Is that an E or an ES? Probably it's E. Good. Get one like that. So the letters that you will mark are not already bubbled in. Some of them are shaded a darker color, and the Scantron reader has trouble with that. Get it so that the letters that you see are on a white background, and that will be perfect. Okay, and then to bubble in one of those letters, which would be your choice for an answer, you need a pencil, and probably even more importantly, you need a really good eraser so that if you erase one of if you mark a selection and change your mind, you want to be able to erase it completely so there's no smudges left. Okay, so that is everything. Anybody have any questions over lecture from last time? Pretty good so far? All right, let me see if I can get a nice presentation going here for you. That looks good. And then I'm going to go like that. Okay. All right, so this is where we left off. I wrote this on the board last time. So the circle is a cell, and K stands for, who knows what K stands for? Potassium. Yeah, not vitamin K, but potassium. You got to know how to read that periodic table. And what does this little plus mean right here? The charge on that particular particle, which makes it a cation. That's really good. I was going to say ion, but it is a cation. And what kind of cation? Monovalent. It just has a plus one charge. All right. And if I had another particle over here with a minus sign on it, right? Let me just put something that has a minus sign on it. Will the potassium repel the chlorine, or would it attract? Right, opposite charges attract. Opposite electrical charges attract. All right, I just want you to be aware of that. All right, so here we have a cell in solution, and the number of potassiums that you see defines what the concentration is. I can't really draw a concentration, but if there's 5 potassiums here and 5 potassiums there, I want you to realize that the concentration would be the same. Or if there's 1 potassium here, the concentration of potassium would be higher over here. All right, so here is a cell, and this membrane is permeable to potassium. We drop that cell in solution with this particular concentration, come back on Tuesday, what's going to be the concentration inside the cell? It's going to be equal, that's right, because potassium can get across the membrane, All right, so just make sure that you see that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How did I do? Looks good. Concentration is the same. And when the concentration is the same, what about diffusion? It stops. Yeah, it stops. It just means that the ones that go in equal the ones that leave. But overall diffusion stops. All right, case number two, we're going to change something about this cell. And we're going to put a protein. Here's a big protein that's inside the cell. And because it's so big, it cannot get across the cell membrane. What kind of particle is that when it cannot get across the cell membrane? It's osmotically active. Yeah, it's osmotically active. And also, this protein has a lot of negative charges on it. Can't get outside the cell. And there's no potassium inside the cell. So what does potassium want to do? It can get across the membrane. What is potassium going to do? It's going to go down its concentration gradient, right, by diffusion. And what else is going to draw it into the cell? The electrical gradient as well, right? All these negative charges are going to draw potassium inside the cell. So there's two forces. And what about over here? Just one, just concentration only. No electrical properties. All right, so if we put this cell in the solution and come back on Monday, what's going to be the concentration of potassium? Over here, they're equal. What about over here? Okay, so potassium is going to enter the cell, go down its concentration gradient, but remember, opposite charges attract, so this protein is going to attract some additional potassiums inside the cell. All right, and I'm just going to draw that by maybe putting 6 or 7 potassiums right here. All right, so more potassium enters the cell. And then if we come back in a really long time, like on Monday, there is no more diffusion or movement of potassium. It has come to an equilibrium. And we're going to see potassium higher inside the cell. But there can't be so much potassium entering the cell that it will neutralize every single minus sign or negative charge on this protein. Right? Because that's going to the negative charges will draw potassium in, but after a long period of time, we have a higher concentration of potassium on the inside than the outside. So what can you tell me about diffusion right now? Say on Monday when we come back. Potassium's high on the inside, low on the outside. Yeah, potassium is going to want to go leave the cell. Right? When it's high concentration inside, low outside, potassium is going to want to leave. But when it's at equilibrium, these negative charges will prevent that from happening. Right, so no diffusion is going to take place, but the cell is still going to have some residual negative charges that aren't canceled out by potassium. Right? Because as soon as one potassium goes in to cancel out that negative charge, then there's enough potassium by concentration inside the cell to actually leave. Right, so there are two forces. Right, there is that concentration force and the electrical force, and at this new equilibrium, okay, they actually oppose each other. At equilibrium, then this arrow right here, right, says because if we have higher potassium on the inside, it's going to want to leave, but because of these negative charges, potassium is going to enter. These two motions will cancel each other out exactly. Right, so you can see electrical. Okay. And then chemical forces. All right, so that's where we left it last time. Let me find where we were. Okay, yeah, we were really close to right in here. Okay, membrane potential. Yeah.
So when the cell inside reaches the equilibrium, both concentrations are
okay, the concentration will be higher inside the cell than outside. So because it's high inside the cell, potassium will want to diffuse out. Okay, but because there are negative charges inside the cell, that potassium will be drawn into the cell. It won't. Okay? But there can't be so much potassium that it will neutralize every single negative charge on that protein. Because as soon as a potassium goes in to neutralize an electrical charge, then the concentration gradient is so big, some potassium is going to diffuse out. Okay? So at equilibrium, as many that are attracted to the inside the cell by the electrical charge is going to equal the number of potassium that leave the cell. So there's no net movement of potassium across the cell membrane. Okay. So here is probably another good take-home thing to remember. What is going to be the overall charge inside this cell? Okay, because we said there can't be enough potassium entering the cell to neutralize every single electrical charge, because then the concentration gradient gets so big it would diffuse out. So at this equilibrium, a funny state appears. So it's negative on the inside and positive on the outside. And this is pretty much all set up by this protein right here because it has a charge on it. Okay? So this is not a stable configuration, because what can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other, right? So that's sort of an unstable situation. All right, let's work with that for a second. All right, so looking at the screen, arrow options visible. Nice. Okay, so here is that case number two that we have drawn on the board. Here are those fixed anions, and of course you know that if something has a negative charge, that is an anion. These are cations. We call these things potassium. So this negative charge is going to draw positive charges or cations inside the cell to neutralize this negative charge. But as the concentration gets larger inside the cell, then there is a force for diffusion, right? Because now there's a concentration gradient. So some of these cations are going to diffuse out of the cell. At equilibrium, these two forces are the same. The electrical attraction cancels out the concentration gradient or the concentration attraction, right? Okay. Do you have kind of a sense of that? And what we're left over is some unneutralized charges, negative charges on this fixed anion, like a protein. So the overall charge inside the cell is going to be negative compared to the outside. All right, so here we have negative on the inside, positive on the outside. And that's because potassium can move across the membrane. All right, and we can actually measure that electrical charge difference by putting a voltmeter. And a voltmeter has two leads to it. And if this was a battery, you would put one lead on the positive terminal and the other one on the negative terminal, and this little needle would move back and forth, and you could actually measure the voltage. And when you check a battery at home, pretty much that's what that little device does if you have a battery checker. And if we think about just potassium, okay, that means then at equilibrium, the charge across this membrane is going to be minus 90 millivolts, minus 90, at equilibrium. Okay, so what? Okay, so how would we check the voltage on a battery? How could we check the voltage on a battery? Okay, battery has two terminals. You would use a voltmeter. Okay, you would use a voltmeter to measure the voltage. And if there's voltage across the battery, those battery terminals, then you know that that battery is charged up and it can do some work. What happens if you put a voltmeter on those two terminals and it reads zero voltage? What can you tell me about that battery? The battery is dead, right? And you know what? If you put a voltmeter across the cell membrane and there's no voltage across it, what could you tell me about this cell? Just like the battery, the cell is going to be dead as well. So that's how important this electrical charge is. So what does every cell in your body act like? It acts like a battery, and that's a storage form of energy, and that's one way cells can store energy, and that electrical gradient can be used for a number of different things, and we're going to talk about that through the whole course. All right, so we saw that the cell becomes negative on the inside. We can actually use an equation to calculate what the negative charge is going to be if we know the concentration of potassium on the inside and the outside. At equilibrium, it will tell us what the voltage is going to be across the membrane, which is kind of handy. Or if we know the voltage across the membrane, we could then calculate the concentration gradient because they're related to each other. And that's what this next cell is all about. It's the Nernst equation. It gives the membrane voltage needed to counteract the concentration forces acting on an ion, right? So that means that when potassium builds up inside the cell, it will want to diffuse out, but this voltage right here is going to draw enough in so that the potassium is always going to be higher inside the cell than outside, even at equilibrium. And the question is, what would be that voltage that would be developed? And we get that from the Nernst equation. So E sub X is the voltage. E depends on those ions that we're talking about. This is going to be in millivolts. The 61 I'll give to you, but you got to know this Z. The Z comes from the valence of a particular ion. What's the valence of potassium? Plus one. That's even better to say, plus one. So that's really nice because if you divide 61 by plus one, what do you get? 61. That's really nice and easy. All right, so we're done with this term. And then we have to know the concentration of some ion. We're going to say any kind of ion. We're going to call that X on the outside divided by inside and then take the log of that, calculate that, and that would tell us the voltage across the membrane. And we could measure, we could calculate what it would be for sodium when it's an ion, or calcium when it's an ion, or chlorine when it's an ion. I wrote that on the board just a little bit a while ago. What kind of charge does chlorine have? I'll give you a hint. NaCl is a very stable compound. It's a minus one, right? So it's a monovalent anion. So in this particular case, what would we put here for Z? A minus one. So you divide 61 by one, okay, still 61, but you got to multiply by that minus sign. So it would end up being minus 61 times whatever that concentration difference is inside and out, take the log of it, and then you would know what the electrical charge is, and then this X would be Cl, right, would be Cl, concentration of chlorine outside, concentration of chlorine inside. All right, so here is a slide, and I got the Nernst equation right here. And it says calculate what the equilibrium potential would be for potassium. And then calculate what would be the equilibrium potential or the voltage across the membrane for sodium. So what do we need to know? We need to know that, and let's do the first one first, potassium. We got to find the concentration outside for potassium and inside. Do we have that information? It's right here. So we look at potassium. What is it outside the cell? 5 millimolar, what's it inside? 150 millimolar. All right, so here, okay, this 150 millimolar potassium is high, it's low on the outside. Which way is potassium going to want to go according to this concentration gradient? Outside, right? But at equilibrium, okay, don't forget there's an anion in here that's going to hold on to some of these potassiums. And so it's not going to equalize, right, completely, and there's going to be some residual charge across the membrane that's still going to be negative on the inside because it's holding these positive charges in. And what would be that voltage? You would use the Nernst equation to calculate that. All right. And so you could calculate the equilibrium potential, the voltage for each of these ions by themselves. And that's what the Nernst equation is for. You can't put all these ions together in one equation because it just doesn't work that way. It doesn't work very well. All right, so another thing that I want you to know on this slide is to not know the numbers necessarily of the concentration of these ions, but I do want you to know the relative difference inside to outside. So if we look at sodium, where is it at a high concentration? Outside the cell. Yeah, you're going to be really familiar with that. Where is potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell. Where is chlorine at a high concentration? Outside the cell. And calcium is at a high concentration outside the cell as well. Look at, oh my goodness, it's almost zero. Calcium, free calcium inside the cell is pretty close to zero. And if you wanted to find out what kind of membrane potential would develop, right, due to this calcium at equilibrium, what kind of equation would you use to figure out what the voltage is across the membrane? The Nernst equation, and then of course you have to know how to use that little log button on your calculator. Okay. Which ions are, so you got to know ions are at a high concentration inside, and you got to know which ions are high outside the cell. So that you just have to memorize, because we're going to use that a lot in this class. All right, so how would we actually calculate that number for potassium? What's the valence for potassium? Plus one. And what is the concentration outside? 5 millimolar. Inside is 150 millimolar. Maybe you want to put some parentheses around this number because you have to divide 5 by 150 before you take the log of it, and then you multiply it by 61, and then you would end up with minus 90 millivolts just due to the potassium. And you could do the same thing for sodium. What's the valence for sodium? Plus 1, just like potassium. And the concentration then for sodium is going to be opposite, right? It's going to be high outside the cell, 145. And it's going to be low, 12 millimolar inside. Divide these two numbers together, take the log, multiply by 61, and you don't have to multiply by plus 1, right? And that is plus 60 millivolts. Okay. And you could calculate it, so you can practice with your calculator using those numbers, and even calculate for chlorine and calcium too, if you want. There is a membrane at rest, and that means that there are no ions moving across the cell membrane. It's just in a resting state. It's not producing any kind of electrical impulses. It's not transmitting information. And in most cells, that equilibrium potential is between minus 65 and minus 85. And in this class, we're pretty much always going to say that resting membrane potential is, where's that voltmeter? I thought I saw the number. It's going to be minus 70. Did you see it here someplace? No. The next slide. Right there. Minus 70, right? If it's a real cell, okay, if we measure the voltage, it's going to turn out to be minus 70. Okay, the very next slide. And so that resting membrane potential, we calculated at equilibrium. It depends on the concentrations of ions that high on the inside or low on the outside. We've got to know what the concentrations are inside and outside. But it also depends on the permeability for each of those ions. So the Nernst equation can't tell us what a real cell is like because these ions actually can move across the membrane. And that minus 70 is most affected by the potassium moving because it's the most permeable. So we can't use the Nernst equation to calculate that the inside of the cell is going to be exactly minus 70 millivolts because of all those things that interact with each other. But they do play a role, and this is what the resting membrane potential looks like, minus 70. Okay. So at rest, right, sodium is going to want to diffuse in, potassium is going to want to move out, and let's look at this pump. You're kind of familiar with this pump already. And this is primary active transport. So what other molecule would you like to draw in right here? ATP, right? And that's pretty much the definition of a pump. When something goes from low concentration to high concentration, that requires energy. And if it's ATP, that's primary active transport. Sodium is going to go from low concentration inside to high concentration outside. Again, that's active transport requiring that energy from ATP. Right? And these things are working all the time. So this pump pumps different amounts of potassium compared to sodium across the membrane, right? So it's 2 for potassium, 3 for sodium. We've actually looked at this before. So what happens to the cell? The charge inside the cell, if 2 positives enter for every 3 that leave, it becomes negative as well, right? So that's going to add to the resting membrane potential, makes it a little bit more negative just because of this pump right here. All right, so I think you can have a pretty good intuitive feeling for that. So the resting membrane potential is determined by a number of things. And let's go right down here to the bottom. All right, it's due to the difference of concentration of ions across the membrane, and you could calculate what it is for one ion at a time, like sodium and potassium. All right, so what would happen if we added plus 66 with minus 90? Would we get minus 70? We would not even close. So there's other things that are involved, like these fixed anions inside the cell. That will add to the negative charges inside the cell. And permeabilities is probably the most important item that determines the resting membrane potential. And you're just going to have to work with that for a little bit to believe me that that's true. All right, so you just remember that for now. Permeability, so it's fixed anions, permeability of the membrane, the concentration gradient across the membrane, right, produces a voltage, and if you add all of these things together, a normal cell is going to be negative on the inside to the magnitude of minus 70 millivolts. All right, so there's really not a bunch of steps in here you can follow. Because we have these numbers, it looks like there should be a nice, easy equation where we could just add numbers together to get to this minus 70, but that's not the case because all of these things influence each other. So if you change the equilibrium potential for potassium, that changes everything else. So you can't just add the numbers up. So minus 70 is a good number for you to memorize. All right, so again, when you measure a voltage across the cell and it's zero, what can you tell me about a cell?
Dead.
It's dead, right. And if you measure minus 70 millivolts, you know that is a typical normal cell at rest. All right, we're going to come back and use that in a couple chapters coming up. Let's change the topic a little bit and talk about cell signaling. And in anatomy, I like to use a concept that we call the structural and functional unit of some kind of function. Like the structural and functional unit of contraction. Can anybody remember what the structural and functional unit of contraction is? So it's got to be a muscle, right? Because muscles are specialized to contract. And that special machine inside a muscle that allows it to contract is a sarcomere. Right? So if you know all the pieces of a sarcomere and how it works, you know how the whole muscle works, which is really nice. Right? So that's the structural and functional unit of contraction. Does anybody know what the structural and functional unit of a cell is? The structural and functional unit of a cell? Okay. The cell is the structural and functional unit of life. So if you know how a cell works, then you pretty much know how all life works because life is built on cells. And if there is something that you're looking at and you're trying to figure out if it's alive or not, then you could just look through a microscope to see if it's a cell. And if it's not a cell, you know that it is not alive. It has to be alive. And to be a cell, we'll talk about that in the next chapter. So the concept I want to talk about here is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. So cells do communicate with each other, and they do that through a unit called a synapse. That's a structural and functional unit. There are two kinds of synapses. There are electrical and there are chemical, and I think we're going to talk about the electrical synapses first. All right, so what do you see so far that we've talked about? It jumps right out at you. Phospholipid bilayer, right? Okay, so I see a phospholipid bilayer up over here, kind of makes part of a cell, and then I see another part of the cell over here. And what about hydrophilic compounds? Can they move from the top cell into the bottom cell? Okay, because of this hydrophobic region inside both of these membranes. Except, look at this membrane, it's been modified. There's some proteins that are added to both membranes, they line up perfectly, and they form a channel. Right? And there's water in that channel. So guess what can move from the top cell to the bottom cell? Hydrophilic molecules. Right? And probably the one we're going to use the most in this class is sodium. Okay? So when the top cell becomes excited, it's going to allow sodium to go into the cell. Sodium is an excitatory event. So now you have high sodium in the top cell, low sodium in the bottom cell. what's going to happen when it gets through, this is what we call a gap junction. What happens to the bottom cell? Sodium is going to enter, and that's going to be an excitatory event, right? That's going to change something inside the cell. And so the thing that is moving, you should think of, is the electrical charge is moving. That sodium has an electrical charge, and so this gap junction would be an example of an electrical synapse because it is sodium that is moving from one side to from one cell to the other. All right. Let's look at some different kinds of chemical synapses, ways to think about them. I see a couple tissues here. I see one row of tissue, just a single row, and then I see, well, maybe it could be some smooth muscle, all right? And this top row of cells is producing a chemical, and it's secreting it into the interstitial space, and then that chemical is going to move from high concentration near these cells to lower concentration around these cells. And these secretory particles can influence the physiology of the cells down below it, right? Because these cells down below it have something that can recognize these signaling molecules. Yeah, it's got to have a receptor. So there are receptors in the cell membrane, okay? And this little sphere can bind to the receptor, and when it does, it's going to change the physiology of the cell down below it. And how would you explain why this nice spherical molecule will bind to a receptor? It's by the shape. Yeah, I use hand and glove kind of analogy, right? So the receptor has to be, some part of it has to be spherical or round or curved for this ball to fit into it. And when it does, it changes the physiology of the cell that had that receptor. This kind of signaling compound that moves by diffusion, short distances, is what we call a paracrine regulator. Paracrine regulator. And what does a target cell have to be, by definition, to be a target cell or a target tissue? There might be other cells in this area, okay, that cannot sense this signaling compound. And so it cannot be a target tissue because what is it missing? It's missing the receptor, right? So in order to be a target cell or target tissue, it has to have a receptor to that particular compound. All right, so what must a target cell contain in order to respond to a signal molecule? It's got to have a receptor. What must be the shape of the binding site of the shape of the binding site and that of the paracrine receptor? Yeah, it's got to be the same shape. That's right, so these things bind by shape. Here is, okay, another example of a kind of synapse. This is a chemical synapse. And I see a muscle down over here, and then I see a neuron. And I think at this time you would be able to recognize this to be a neuron after anatomy. And this is a nice skeletal muscle cell. And this neuron is going to instruct this muscle cell to contract. And that first instance we looked at, we saw that sodium moved from one cell to the other, right, by diffusion. That doesn't happen in this particular case because there's a big space between the neuron and the muscle cell. So sodium just can't move across through a gap junction. They're separated. So here is a chemical compound that's released by a neuron. Right, here's the axon terminus. And the axon terminus releases a chemical when a nerve impulse comes down the axon. And then that compound is going to diffuse from high concentration to low concentration around this muscle cell, and it will bind to something that we call a receptor, right? And these things match up because they have the right shape, complementary shape to each other. And when this compound secreted by the neuron binds to the receptor, then the physiology of this cell is going to change. And what would you know what would happen on this cell? It would contract, right? Because it's a muscle cell. So this compound that's released by a neuron is called a neurotransmitter that is carrying the information that was in the neuron to the muscle cell, and that's what tells the muscle cell to contract. So this is a good example of a chemical synapse because what is moving from one cell to another? It is a chemical. It's not an electrical signal. Right? A neuron uses electrical signals to move down the axon very fast. Right? So you have an electrical signal in a neuron. It gets converted to a chemical. The chemical moves across the synapse. It binds to a receptor. And that starts another electrical event on this skeletal muscle cell. So we have information is transmitted electrically, then chemically, and then electrically once again. So that is an example of a chemical synapse. Here is something that you're probably familiar with already in terms of cell signaling. Here I see a bunch of cells, and more cases than not, this is an epithelium. Epithelium form glands, and this gland is producing something inside the cells and then secreting it into the interstitial space. And where does that end up? Where does that particle end up? In the blood. Okay, what kind of blood vessel will allow diffusion of this particle into the blood? A capillary, because what's the function of a capillary that you know? Exchange. And as a matter of fact, that's the only place where exchange can happen, only in a capillary, not an artery or a vein or a small artery or a small vein. And then once that particle is in the blood, where does it go? Everywhere in the body, right? Everywhere in the body, wherever blood goes. And if there's another capillary, some other place, then that compound can diffuse out into the interstitial space and it can bump into a whole bunch of cells. Some cells will react to this signaling compound and some won't. Okay, how would you explain why some cells won't react? They don't have a receptor, but some cells have a receptor, and if they have a receptor, when that compound binds to it, it's going to change the physiology of these cells, and then we call this what kind of tissue or cell or organ, because it has a receptor, that is a target tissue, target cell, target organ. All right, so this particular bunch of cells producing that chemical, if it gets into the blood, right, and it's transmitted everywhere in the blood, changes some physiology at a distant location, that compound is what we call a hormone. What did we call something that a neuron releases and carries information to, say, that skeletal muscle cell by diffusion, a short distance? Okay, neurotransmitter, all right? Hormones, right, are released, but not by a neuron. And how far away can a target tissue be? Really, really far away, right? For a neurotransmitter, it has to be a neighboring cell. So this kind of gland that secretes a hormone into the blood that travels to some distant location and changes the physiology of that tissue, we call that an endocrine gland, right? So if this cell is secreting a compound and it goes into the blood, right, that compound is what we call a hormone, and a hormone is always secreted by an endocrine gland. You're probably familiar with another kind of gland, but I think you should probably just remember what it is, just to kind of be complete here. You have endocrine glands, and what's another kind of gland? Exocrine glands. And what makes an exocrine gland different from an endocrine gland? Okay, the big difference is that an exocrine gland has a duct that carries that product to some other location in the body, but an endocrine gland does not have a duct. It releases the product, and then the circulatory system delivers it to wherever it wants to go, right? And that would be a target tissue. Okay. All right, so how do regulatory molecules influence target cells? So here is that signaling compound right here, and it's going to change the physiology inside the cell. But probably the easiest way to understand how it can change the physiology inside the cell is if this signaling compound can actually enter the cell, if it can get inside the cell, okay, and then change something, change the physiology. But now what do you have to tell me about some physical properties of this signaling compound if it can just diffuse across the cell membrane? Okay, this one right here. It can diffuse across the membrane. Tell me the nature of this inner part of the membrane. Is it polar or nonpolar? It's nonpolar, which means that it is what, hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's a hydrophobic region. But this molecule can move right across it without any kind of problem. So this particle is what, hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic. It can move across the membrane. And the receptors for this hydrophobic molecule or nonpolar molecule is intracellular. It's inside the cell. And can you see this? We're going to call this a ligand. A little particle that binds to some bigger receptor is a ligand. Can you see that the shape of this ligand matches up very nicely with the shape of the receptor inside the cell? Okay. So when this receptor becomes activated, it can move into the nucleus and it can change how RNA is being produced or what genes are going to be used to make proteins. And so these proteins have different shapes. They will enter, they'll be produced in the cytoplasm. So now you have different shaped molecules inside the cytoplasm. What's going to happen to the physiology of this cell? If you're changing the shape of even molecules inside the cell, you'll change the physiology. Some examples of compounds, and you're pretty familiar with this already, some signaling compounds that are hydrophobic are steroids because they are lipids, thyroid hormones because they have a lot of nonpolar regions on them, and also this gas, nitric oxide, can diffuse across the cell membrane. So where would be a receptor for a thyroid hormone? Would it be outside the cell or inside the cell? Inside the cell. And what usually happens if there is an intracellular receptor, it changes what happens inside the nucleus. It allows more and different kinds of proteins to be made. And we're going to talk about that pretty soon. Okay, so this is for what? A hydrophobic regulatory molecule because it can move across the membrane. What kind of signaling compound cannot move across the membrane? A polar compound or a hydrophilic compound. So if the hydrophilic compound is being used to signal the cell, it can't get inside the cell to bind to any of these receptors, so where does the receptor have to be? It's got to be outside the cell, right? And that's your next slide. All right, so hydrophilic regulatory molecules have to have a binding site outside the cell, and then for years and years and years, nobody had the slightest clue, how does that message get from outside the cell to the inside if this signaling compound can't even get inside the cell? How does that happen? Well, we have a pretty good idea now. Right, so here we have that nice phospholipid bilayer. This compound can't get in, but the receptor is outside the cell. When it binds to a receptor, it changes some chemistry on this side, on the inside surface of the cell membrane, and something else is produced, another kind of chemical. Right? And now that other kind of chemical builds up in concentration inside the cell. And that second compound that builds up can change the physiology of the cell. So the hydrophilic regulatory molecule, sometimes we just call these messengers. And where do you always find the first messenger? Outside the cell. And the second messenger is always going to be inside the cell. We call this a signal transduction scheme because it's taking a signal from outside, bringing it to the inside of the cell. And there has to be a receptor to do that. So just remember that first messengers are always outside, second messengers are always inside, and we're going to look at a couple of different kinds of second messengers that build up inside the cell. And here is a little list. For instance, ions can. Calcium. Well, from one of those previous slides that we looked at, where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. Because if it was high concentration on the inside, it can't be used as a second messenger because it's already at a high concentration. But if it's at low concentration and then some calcium diffuses into the cell, okay, or is released inside the cell, then it can become a second messenger. Cyclic AMP. We just put a little C right here. That's a special form of AMP that forms a ring, and you get, how do you get AMP? So if you have adenosine triphosphate with three phosphates, if a phosphate is taken off and then another phosphate is taken off, you're left with one. That's with this monophosphate. And then if it becomes a ring structure, then you get cyclic AMP, kind of a special structure, and that can be used as a second messenger. What kind of reaction would your body use to take an ATP and remove a phosphate from it? and then remove a second phosphate from it. Hydrolysis reaction, right. Hydrolysis always takes a big molecule, makes it into a smaller one. G-proteins we're going to look at probably on the next slide. A couple other compounds we're going to look at in a month or so. Diacylglycerate, we're just going to call that DAG. Inositol-3-phosphate, we're just going to call that IPI-3. Okay, IPI-3. So DAG and IPI-3 can be second messengers inside the cell. So the nature of the hormone that is going to allow IPI-3 to build up inside the cell. Okay, what can you tell me about the physical chemistry of that hormone that's going to allow IPI-3 to build up inside the cell? What can you tell me about that hormone? That hormone that's going to allow a second messenger to build up inside the cell is always a hydrophilic molecule because it can't get across the membrane. So second messengers are produced by hydrophilic compounds because they can't get across the membrane. And so that signaling compound outside the cell is the first messenger, and whatever inside the cell is what we call the second messenger. A G protein is one of the more important kinds of second messenger systems or transduction systems that we know. And I'm not going to read this to you. I'm just going to go right to the illustration. And this G protein will take a signal from outside the cell to the inside of the cell for hydrophilic compounds. And almost all life forms will use some kind of G protein. So it's very common. We say it's conserved throughout evolution, and it's used by almost every organism. Probably could find some where it doesn't operate, but in most organisms it does. So there is going to be a signaling compound outside the cell. We're going to call that a first messenger, right? And that's going to allow some changes on the inside by producing a second messenger. Let's look at this complex right here. So here we see the regulatory molecule. It's going to bind to a site on, so what would we call this thing? It has a binding site for this ligand. So here is the receptor. The receptor goes all the way across the membrane. And then on the cellular side of this receptor, there are three special particles. 1, 2, 3. But we're going to call it alpha, beta, and gamma. You could have called it 1, 2, 3. And on this alpha particle, there is a binding site for GTP. GTP is very similar to ATP. So you know a little bit about ATP. So tell me a little bit of something about ATP. What does it contain? Energy, right, in the form of chemical bonds. So GTP contains energy, just like ATP. And the amount of energy is almost exactly the same. Okay. So in this step right here, GTP binds to the alpha particle, and there just so happened to be a GDP at that site. It has to come off to allow GTP to enter. When GTP enters that binding site, there is a dissociation of these three particles into two, right? It's not into three separate particles, but into two. One is that alpha unit, and then the beta and gamma get stuck together as well, but at least the beta and gamma are separated from the alpha unit, and they're released from the receptor, as long as you have that regulatory molecule bound to it. When they're released into the from the receptor, they can wander around all over the place. They can travel along the inside of the membrane, move around inside the cell. Right? So in this particular case, right, then this alpha subunit is going to build up inside the cell. The beta and gamma is going to build up inside the cell. What kind of messengers are these things? Second messengers. And what started the buildup or production of these second messengers? The first messenger, which we just call regulatory molecule, right? So regulatory molecule always outside, and it is the first messenger. In this particular case, this G protein is the second messenger. And guess why somebody called this a G protein? Because they could get it to work if they fed it GTP, right, in a test tube or however they started to work with these things. All right, so we have the subunits split apart, and they can wander around. This beta and gamma subunit can bump into another protein in the cell membrane, And this thing can maybe be a channel that opens or closes, or it could be an enzyme that becomes activated. In either case, it's going to change the physiology of the cell. Okay. So the second messenger can activate some kind of effector, maybe changing the voltage across the cell or making some proteins appear because of protein synthesis is initiated, or maybe a protein is broken down into some active parts. And the same thing for the alpha particle. Alpha particle can bump into an effector as well. Like I said, any kind of membrane channel, it can open a channel that's closed or close a channel that's open. All depends on what the cell wants to do. Then after a while, the beta gamma is going to break away from the effector. The alpha unit is going to break away from the receptor. They can recombine at the receptor. And when they recombine at the receptor, some energy is going to be required, and that's when GTP is what into GDP? What's the reaction that takes place? Hydrolysis. It's just a nice hydrolysis reaction. So there is a GTPase on the alpha subunit that hydrolyzes that GTP into GDP, right? And then the cycle can start all over once again. Right? So now we have GDP in this active site. When it moves up over to here, the regulatory molecule binds. That's going to kick GDP out, and then GTP can enter that site. Right? So, and then these things can dissociate. Right? They can wander around in the cell, activate other kinds of effectors, and when they recombine, that GTP that initially bound to the alpha subunit becomes hydrolyzed, and that makes another a nice activated unit, right? It's not stimulated, but when it comes stimulated with this regulatory molecule, then these things dissociate. All right, so this is a really nice example of how a G protein works. So can you see that something outside the cell changes something inside the cell? That's the whole point of this, and you should probably have in your mind what that's called. When something outside the cell changes something inside the cell, it's called signal transduction, right? That signal is moving across the cell membrane even though that first messenger can't get in, right? Because this G protein is special. Okay, so that is what's on this word slide right here. G protein is part of a second messenger pathway in many cells. The G protein contains three subunits whose components dissociate when a cell surface receptor is activated, right? And a cell surface means on the outside of the cell, right? And then those subunits bind to some other kind of protein in the cell membrane, maybe an ion channel or an enzyme, changing their activity, and it changes the physiology of the cell. All right, so we see a G protein has three subunits. Let's go back to here. I see, when I look at this G protein, I see 1, 2, 3, 4 subunits. Why did we say 3? Okay, and that's because this one right here that looks kind of square, that's not a G protein, that is a receptor, right? The G proteins are only these three subunits, the alpha, beta, and gamma. So sometimes we talk about this whole complex, that is a G protein, but as a G protein coupled receptor, right? And this is the receptor part, and this is the G protein part. Okay, G protein coupled receptor is this whole thing right here. All right, so that's it for this chapter, and we can move on to another chapter, but let's ask me some questions. Anybody have any questions? Yeah. Okay, target cells and receptors. Nice concept.
So the receptors are always going to be on the plasma and also listed by their part.
Okay, so a really good question. Are receptors always going to be associated with the phospholipid bilayer or the membrane? Is a receptor always going to be on a membrane? Only for one particular case, and that is if that signaling compound is a hydrophilic molecule. The receptor is going to be on the membrane because that hydrophilic molecule can't get inside the cell because that's because the membrane, oh, here it is right here. I don't know what happened to it. Okay, that signaling compound can't get inside the cell, so the receptor has to be extracellular. But if it's a signaling compound like a steroid, right, then steroids can move across the membrane, so those receptors are intracellular. Right, so hydrophobic signaling compounds have intracellular receptors, and hydrophilic signaling compounds have extracellular receptors, because that those compounds just can't get inside the cell.
Then where are the target cells found?
The target cells can be found anywhere in your body. So if it's an endocrine system, right, that signaling compound goes to a really distant location and it leaves the circulatory system, and so that target tissue could be in your toe, and the endocrine gland can be in your neck, for instance. And it can send a signal down there because that signal gets into the blood and it travels down there, right? But what does that thing in your toe have to have in order to sense that signaling compound that's coming from your neck? It has to have a receptor. And let's just say no other cells in your body have a receptor. Are they going to be sensitive to that compound that's coming from your neck? They won't be. Okay? So that's one way things work. Or they can move over short distances, like a neurotransmitter. It just moves across the synapse. So it's a microscopic distance. And it doesn't flow in the blood. It just moves by diffusion. And diffusion works only for very, very short distances, microscopic distances. Okay? Okay. So receptors can be anywhere in the body, and our body is designed so that when a signaling compound is released, there is a target tissue someplace that's going to be coordinated by that signal. Let's see if I can find a slide. Nice. Yeah. Ah, okay. So you don't have second messenger. I'm glad this popped up. You don't have a second messenger system if the molecule is hydrophobic, right? Because that molecule can enter the cell all by itself. But if the molecule can't enter, that means what? That it is hydrophilic, right? So let's look at this one. If it's hydrophilic, one way that it changes the physiology inside the cell is through this second messenger system. So yes, for sure, this hydrophilic molecule can't get inside the cell. It has to bind to a receptor that is extracellular, and then that's going to cause the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell. And there's a number of different mechanisms and second messengers that we're going to look at. The first one we looked at is that G protein coupled receptor complex. So somewhere in there I answered your question, but I gave you a lot more background. Did you find an answer in there for your question? Yes? Okay, good. Okay. So second messengers only are used for hydrophilic molecules because they can't get inside the cell. If they can, then there's no need for a second messenger system. Okay, yeah. Oh, the receptor itself. Okay. The receptor itself, I wouldn't think of it in terms of hydrophilic or hydrophobic. I'm just thinking about the signaling compound. Okay. In order for a protein to be placed into a membrane, it's got to be kind of special. This region right here of the protein has to be nonpolar, and then either end has to be polar if it's going to sit in the membrane just like that and move across the membrane. Yeah, so it's got to have properties of both. It's got to have properties of both. And then there's probably some electrical charges in there that allow it to orient itself across this living cell because there's an electrical difference between here. Okay. So, yeah, maybe that was your question. These receptors themselves, I wouldn't consider them hydrophilic or hydrophobic. Only this signaling compound right here is what you should think about. Okay. Yes. Okay. There are so many proteins inside the cell that have a negative charge that if the cell's job was to export that A protein out of the cell, there'd be so many left, and the electrical charge probably wouldn't change very much. Okay, and so all of the proteins that will always stay inside the cell will, as a group, have an overall negative charge. So there are proteins that can't leave the cell. Okay, yeah. So that's just a concept of thousands of proteins inside the cell that have negative charge on them. Okay, so let's go on to chapter 3. Nice, chapter 3. You see it here. This is a pretty easy chapter, I think, because it's sort of a review of what you know in anatomy, cell structure and genetic control. And so we're going to learn about some structures. The first organelle that we're going to talk about is the plasma membrane. And before we get to the plasma membrane, here is a cell. And I want to tell you what a cell is to begin with, right? In order to be a cell, you have to have genetic material inside of it, right? And then, sorry, let me get my cursor back. So here I see a cell with a nucleus, and there's genetic material inside the nucleus. This is information that can be passed on from generation to generation, but this also contains information on how to make the shapes of different kinds of proteins at different times, right? So if the nucleus right here is determining the shape of things inside the cell, what else is it determining? The function of those things, right? Okay. So usually we just skip that step. We usually just say, well, the nucleus controls the function inside the cell. But it does it through by changing the shape of molecules and organelles inside the cell. All right, so a cell has to have genetic material. It does not have to be in a nucleus, but it's got to be in the cell someplace. To be a cell, you have to have a plasma membrane right here. You know a little bit about a plasma membrane. What is the basic description of a plasma membrane? A really simple description of it, but it's highly descriptive. Phospholipid bilayer. That's right. So it's got to have some kind of phospholipid bilayer to be a plasma membrane. And then there's one other component a living cell has to have. It has to have cytoplasm. So it's got to have the right kind of mixture of chemicals, right, that produce living processes. So a cell has to have genetic material, cytoplasm, and a cell membrane. This cell is pretty special because when I look at cytoplasm, I see it's pretty complex. Cytoplasm is made up in this particular cell of organelles, for instance, like a mitochondria. Right? So mitochondria is an organelle, Golgi body is an organelle, centrioles are organelles. And then also the fluid part where you don't see organelles. We call that cytosol. Right? So in order to make cytoplasm, you have to have organelles and cytosol. And some cells don't have organelles, but they have cytosol. That still classifies them to have cytoplasm, so that would be a cell. All you have to have is cell membrane, cytoplasm, or some component of it, and genetic material. There are things that appear to be alive, like viruses. Viruses can infect cells, produce disease processes, and if I were to draw a virus right here, I would draw in genetic material, I would not draw in cytoplasm, and instead of a cell membrane, there would be walls made out of proteins or other kinds of compounds. There would be no plasma membrane. Right? But a virus does contain genetic material. Would you consider a virus to be alive? Okay. Common conception is that a virus is alive, right, because it's infectious. But it's missing two of the three components necessary for life, which is cytoplasm and cell membrane. The only thing it has is genetic material, so it can transmit information from one generation to the next, but it's not a living cell. So that's pretty strange about a virus. Okay, a bacteria is a living cell. It has genetic material, cytoplasm, and a plasma membrane. It doesn't have a nucleus, but it still has genetic material. So what about a bacteria? Is it alive? Genetic material, cytoplasm, plasma membrane, right. It is alive, right? That's what we need to have life. And so if you have a bacterial infection, right, you can kill that life. You can have an antibiotic, and then that alleviates that infection. What about a virus? Can you have a compound that will go in and kill a virus? The answer is no, because a virus is not alive. And that's why viral infections typically are a lot more difficult to treat, because they're not living organisms. You can't kill something that's not alive to begin with. So that's sort of interesting. Okay, so here is the cell. We're going to look at plasma membrane first. You're familiar with this phospholipid bilayer. But this picture right here shows something a little bit more sophisticated, actually a lot more sophisticated. I see more than the phospholipid bilayer. And this is really how we should conceptualize a membrane. I see a whole bunch of other things inserted into the membrane, like maybe a G-protein coupled receptor, right, that we were working with before. And so a good way to think of a plasma membrane in a living cell is with a model in our mind called the fluid mosaic model, right? The fluid part would be the phospholipid bilayer. It's not structurally very strong, right? It moves around a lot. It's very pliable. That is the fluid part. The mosaic part of that model in your mind will be all of these other things that are added to the cell membrane, including some of these cholesterol molecules. What can you tell me about cholesterol? It's a steroid. And where do steroids fit in those four basic kinds of compounds that you're aware of? Yeah, they're lipids, so they are hydrophobic. And where do you find the cholesterol in a membrane? In the hydrophilic or hydrophobic region? In the hydrophobic region, right? So cholesterol dissolves into the membrane, and this cholesterol helps stabilize the phospholipid bilayer, makes it a little bit more sturdy. That's its job. So that's part of the mosaic. Another part of the mosaic, it can have these proteins that move across the membrane, like that G-protein coupled receptor that we looked at. So it can have a whole bunch of other different kinds of proteins. Maybe these things would be enzymes that will promote some kind of chemical process, for instance. Or maybe this could be a channel that opens and closes that allows some other kind of hydrophilic molecule to move across the membrane because it can't by itself. But if there's a channel open, then some compounds can. All right, so when we add different structures to this plasma membrane, what are we doing to the plasma membrane? Changing the function of it. That's right. Okay, I see some sugar molecules. And some of these sugar molecules have a particular shape to them, like this one here, looks like this one over here. Maybe it looks like this one right here. These things are what we call antigens. They have a particular shape, and all the cells in your body have a uniquely shaped antigen on the cell surface, so that your immune system knows that that cell belongs to you by the shape of this antigen that is sticking out into the extracellular space. If some other cell enters your body, and all cells have antigens, and it has a different shape, guess what your body knows? It doesn't belong to you, right? And hopefully it will find some way to kill that cell that's growing there, unless it's a transplant or something. And then you have to dial down the immune system of that patient so that, for instance, if they have a heart transplant, their own immune system doesn't destroy the heart transplant. Okay, so that's some other things. You can have antigens, you can have enzymes and channels. Some proteins move across the membrane, some are stuck on one side, and it all depends, and they all have different kinds of functions. So it all depends on what is necessary. Okay, so transporters, yeah, enzymes, channels, receptors. Could you give me a name of a receptor? You could. Like a G-protein coupled receptor, right, is in the membrane. And then identity markers. What do we call an identity marker? An antigen. Yeah, it is an antigen. Okay. And these compounds can be proteins, or proteins modified with a sugar molecule, or sugar that's modified with a lipid molecule added to it, and it just changes the structure of these molecules that can be associated with the plasma membrane. Yeah. Oh, autoimmune disease. I think that's what you're thinking. So the question was, what happens when some cells in your body die because they're attacked by the body itself? What's going on there? Well, for some reason, the person's immune system has not recognized those cells as being part of your body. Okay, and why could that be? Well, maybe something happened genetically to where this antigen right here changed shape by mistake. Okay, and so then your own immune system attacks this particular cell. So there are a number of different kinds of immune diseases. One, probably a number of them, vitiligo, we think is one. And that's where people lose pigmentation in some part of their skin and it becomes just white. There's no melanin there whatsoever. And then they're really susceptible to sunburn in that area. And we believe that could be an autoimmune disease. And also like psoriasis, when you have really irritated skin in some part of your body, you can sometimes think of that as an autoimmune disease, where cells in that local area of your body now appear to be from someplace else, and your own body rejects it. Another kind of interesting thing, somebody developed a vaccine for cavities. What's a cavity? Where do you have a cavity? Yeah, in your mouth and a tooth. And every once in a while, you got to drill somebody's tooth open and put some kind of filling in it because they have a cavity. Well, somebody developed a really nice vaccine because cavities are produced by a bacteria. And that bacteria lives on the food that you eat, and a byproduct of that digestion is an acid, and then that acid dissolves the tooth, and then you end up with a cavity. Okay. So how could you prevent cavities? Well, you could make sure that you don't have those bacteria there. And one way to kill bacteria is to give somebody a vaccine, right? And then that immune system recognizes the shape of that particular particle. So a vaccine is what? Antigens of whatever organism that you're trying to kill. And it was a bacteria, so they got some antigens for those bacteria, and somebody built a bunch of antibodies against that shape. And they did a bunch of tests, and that vaccine worked really well. Okay, it produced antibodies that killed the bacteria extremely well. But there's a reason why we don't use it today. And that's because the antibodies that are produced from that vaccine not only kill the bacteria, but it also kills the patient's heart. And that's because of what? The shape of antigens on the heart are very closely matched to that particular antigen on the bacteria. So they're looking for other kinds of shapes on cells, and maybe someday somebody will find a nice vaccine for cavities. But not at the moment, right? So you asked the question about antigens, right? So if it's the same shape, so if you develop an immune response or antibodies to a shape, right, or an antigen on a cell, if other cells have that same shape, then those antibodies will destroy that cell. So, and it won't know any different, right? Even though you know you want a heart, but your immune system doesn't, right? It just knows that it doesn't belong there. Okay. Transport in and out of the cell can happen in a number of different ways. And here is one way material that is outside the cell can actually get inside the cell. We call this phagocytosis. If this is a relatively large particle and maybe it can't dissolve into solution. So some cells are shapeshifters. Their cytoplasm can shoot out in one direction and can shoot out over in this direction and then form a sphere around this particle. The sphere then can enter the cell. That sphere is what we call a vesicle. So now this particle is inside a vesicle inside the cell. And generally, we call this endocytosis, right? When something moves from outside to inside, that's endocytosis. This particular kind of endocytotic process is called phagocytosis, and that just means cell eating, right? Because this is a nice solid particle. Sometimes a cell will go through the same process, but it won't endocytose solid particles, but maybe a solution of chemicals that are dissolved in water. In that case, we're going to call that cell drinking. Phagocytosis is cell eating, but cell drinking is what we call pinocytosis. So phagocytosis, pinocytosis are different kinds of endocytosis, right? Because these things are entering the cell. Endocytosis is going inside the cell by producing vesicles that contain that material. Exocytosis is the opposite, where you have something inside a vesicle inside the cell, and then the vesicle moves over to the cell membrane, fuses with the membrane, and whatever was in the vesicle is released to the outside into the extracellular space. So that we call that secretion, but that's exocytosis in work, right? So there's things inside the cell that leave via that vesicle. There are three specializations that we're going to look at, and I think we looked at these in anatomy. Cilia, flagella, and microvilli. These things are projections off the surface of a cell. So here's a really nice high magnification of some of these tubes that are projecting off the surface of a cell. And right here, these look to be cilia. So cilia are relatively short, but they do whip back and forth, right? And when they move back and forth, right, they cause a flow of fluid over the cell. And they can whip back and forth in just a specific way so that there is a one-way motion of fluid, right? So they're sweeping in one direction. And so we call that motility. The function of cilia is motility. And if you're going to know, and you probably should know at least one bullet point for each organelle inside the cell. So if somebody says, what's the function of cilia? You're going to say motility. Some unicellular organs some unicellular organisms can swim around in their environment using cilia. No cells in the human body can swim around, but we do have cilia in cells that are anchored in our body, and they will sweep a surface clean. Like, for instance, your trachea is loaded with ciliated cells. And there are also goblet cells in your trachea. What does a goblet cell do? Mucus. So it secretes mucus onto the surface where the cilia are sweeping and beating all the time. And which way do you think they're sweeping that mucus? And it contains a bunch of dust particles and virus, bacteria, junk you don't want in your body. Is it going to sweep it up or sweep it down? It's going to sweep it up, right? And then when it gets into your mouth, because that's where it ends up, then what do? Yeah, then you just swallow it down. Okay, get it out of your body. Unless you're what? Unless you're a baseball player, right? Then if you're a baseball player, you can probably spit here in class. That would be okay. Okay, so cilia, motility. There's another specialization that's very much like a cilia. It contains the same kind of internal structures, but it's a lot longer. And some cells in the human body have one of these things, and it whips back and forth. In this particular case, it actually moves the cell around. So this particular cell can swim in any kind of aqueous environment. When I say aqueous, what do I mean? Like a watery environment, right? And it can't swim through solids and things like that, but it can swim through water. And we probably all know what kind of cell does that. Only males have that cell. Women have the genetics to make flagella, but it's not expressed. It is expressed in the male. That flagella is added to a sperm cell, right, so that it can swim around and find an egg someplace to fertilize. Microvilli is a structure that looks very much like a cilia, but it's not for motility. What it does is that it increases the length of a membrane, right? And when it increases the length of a membrane, then absorption is enhanced. So microvilli is for absorption, or you could say maybe membrane transport. And so that just increases the size of the doorway in and out of the cell. So cilia, you'd say motility, flagella, motility, microvilli, absorption. It's kind of a big switch. They have similar kind of structures on the inside, namely these microtubules. They all contain microtubules. Okay. All right, let's look at some other organelles. Cytoplasm is what? Cytosol plus organelles together. And here I see that these cells have been stained with a compound that binds to microtubules and maybe even some microfilaments. So let's look at the illustration. Here I see a nice mitochondria, and it's locked in position because I see microtubules attached to it, and the microtubules are attached to other parts of the cell, which kind of then locks this mitochondria into this location. So microtubules not only can position an organelle inside the cell, but it can also push and pull on the membrane, the plasma membrane of a cell, and cause it to be flat, okay, or tall, or square. So microtubules also can determine the shape of a cell. And we were looking at a shape-shifting cell, that macrophage by phagocytosis. That happens by activity of microtubules as well. Another interesting thing about a microtubule is that you could have a vesicle or some other kind of organelle inside the cell, and it can move from this very bottom position up toward the top of the cell. And the way it does that is that there are special motor proteins that are on these microtubules that attach to that vesicle, and then it moves, it pulls the vesicle along to the proper location inside the cell. So in a sense, these microtubules are there for motility, right? But it also determines the shape of the cell. And how I think of a microtubule is that I just see one line. I just see one microtubule right here, and it's acting like a railway system in the car. So things can move around from here to over here, or here or here. And so what do you call a railway system that has one rail on it instead of two? Most trains have two, a monorail, and of course you could go visit one really easy because they are over at Disneyland, right? That's a monorail. So think of that microtubule system as a nice monorail system inside the car. I mean inside the cell. All right, some of these other organelles. We said here's the nucleus. It contains genetic material. And here's mitochondria. And the job of mitochondria is to produce ATP. And we know ATP is energy, so some people say, well, mitochondria produce energy for the cell. And they're right, but because it makes ATP. Okay, so that's its job. In order to make ATP, it needs some nutrient molecules. And a good example of that would be glucose. So it needs glucose, but it also needs something else in order to make ATP. And it's the reason why we inhale. Why do we inhale? Oxygen. Yeah, so mitochondria need nutrient molecules and oxygen, and then it produces a lot of ATP, and ATP can be used by the cell. When oxygen is used to make ATP, when glucose is there, it also produces carbon dioxide, right? And so what do we do with carbon dioxide? We exhale it, right? So we inhale to get oxygen to this mitochondria. We exhale to get that CO2 away from the mitochondria. And so it's interesting that we're breathing all day long just to service mitochondria inside of our bodies. So they're kind of special. And indeed, they are special. We call it a membrane-bound organelle. There's a membrane right here, plasma membrane, and on the inside there's a second membrane. So we call this a double membrane organelle. The inner one is what we call a Christi membrane, and the outer one we just call the outer membrane. All right, so it has a membrane. Another strange thing about mitochondria is that it has a chromosome. And what do you know about a chromosome? Do you know anything about a chromosome? It is genetic material, right? It is genetic material. So here we have a mitochondria that has a cell membrane and genetic material, and it has cytosol. It has cytoplasm on the inside that is alive, right? So what is one way to think of a mitochondria if it has plasma membrane, genetic material, and cytoplasm? It's a life form. It's a cell, right? And if you ever take a microbiology class, when you look at a mitochondria, you're going to say, wow, that really resembles a bacteria. Okay? And a bacteria has all those same three components, so bacteria is alive. And we now, it's commonly recognized, so this is a theory, we call it the endosymbiont theory of mitochondria. At some point, way back in evolution, right, there was a cell that had some organelles in it. It got infected by a bacteria, right? And that bacteria learned to live with the cell. And we call that a symbiosis. Endosymbiont, because the mitochondria is inside the cell. A symbiosis means that both of the parties get something, some benefit from that process. All right, so you know what the cell benefits, because it gets ATP. All right, but why is a mitochondria benefited by being inside the cell? Okay, yeah, that cell is giving it glucose. But I heard another one up over here. Not only is the cell giving it glucose, it's giving it oxygen. And the cell gets ATP, but another thing that this mitochondria gets, it's no longer out in the environment where other bacteria can attack it or other viruses, so protection. Right, so mitochondria is protected when it's inside the cell. So that's a nice symbiosis that takes place there. All right, so we're going to talk about some more organelles on Tuesday. And then on Thursday, I'm not sure what we're going to do. Sign-in sheet is going around.